You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm David Lazarus from the Los Angeles Times, sitting in for Larry Mantle. Check out my Consumer Confidential column in today's business section to see what I get up to when I'm not doing this. Well, coming up later in this hour, we'll be talking about high gas prices and public transportation. What will it take to get you onto the bus? We'll be taking calls on that. But first, President Bush has called for more drilling offshore and up in Anwar. In fact, he wants to roll back nearly a quarter century of a moratorium on drilling off of our coasts to get more oil. Well, we'll be taking your calls on this momentarily about whether you think high gas prices finally makes the case for wanting to go out there and dig for oil off our coast and up in places like Anwar. First, let's hear what the president had to say.
Short run, the American economy will continue to rely largely on oil. And that means we need to increase supply, especially here at home. So my administration has repeatedly called on Congress to expand domestic oil production. Unfortunately, Democrats on Capitol Hill have rejected virtually every proposal. And now Americans are paying the price at the pump for this obstruction. Congress must face a hard reality. Unless members are willing to accept gas prices at today's painful levels or even higher, our nation must produce more oil.
In fact, the White House has even gone out on a limb and said that if we started drilling toot sweet, we could perhaps see an impact on gas prices within a year. Well, we'll be talking to other experts on that momentarily, but to help us make sense of what exactly would happen with the moratorium lifted, let's start with Severin Borenstein. He's director of the University of California Energy Institute. Mr. Borenstein, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on.
Okay, so when the president says that if we can lift the moratorium on offshore drilling and perhaps go exploring in Anwar, we can make a big difference in terms of not just oil prices, but gas prices. Is that an accurate thing for him to say?
No, it's really not. It is certainly the case that there's oil offshore and there's oil in the Anwar, but when you look at how much oil there is, you have to compare it to the entire world supply, because we live in a world oil market. No one is suggesting that this oil would be sufficient to fully meet the U.S. needs. So we're going to remain integrated into that world oil market. So when you think about putting another million or 2 million barrels a day onto the market, you have to compare it to the whole market, which is probably going to by then be nearly 100 million barrels a day. When you sort of think about what impact that's going to have, it would probably lower gas, lower oil prices by 5 or 10%, which would probably lower gas prices maybe by 20 cents a gallon. It would have a little impact, but it would not be any sort of significant change that people are likely to see as a major relief, and it probably wouldn't happen for 5 to 10 years. The idea that next year we would see some significant difference in gas prices because we leased offshore oil drilling areas or allowed drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge is really just not consistent with the way the market works.
Now, the figures I've seen out there say that there's maybe 18 billion barrels of oil offshore that we don't have our fingers on right now. And that sounds like a lot until you realize we use 20 million barrels of oil every single day, or anywhere from 7.3 to 7.6 billion barrels a year. So that doesn't really sound like it makes a big difference at all.
Well, and in fact, even the U.S. use is not the right comparison point. The world uses 86 million barrels a day. And so that's hundreds of billion barrels. Or sorry, that's going to be more like 70 billion barrels a year. So we really need to think of it in that context. And when we think of it in that context, this is just not going to be enough oil to significantly lower prices. That said, we do have to recognize that there is valuable oil in these areas, and that oil is a lot more valuable. The argument for drilling in these areas is that there is now a resource that is even scarcer than it was before, is incredibly valuable, and is being locked up. And if it were removed, if it were extracted, it would be worth a lot of money. Some of that money would go to the U.S. federal government. Some of it would probably go to the local state governments. Some of it would go in royalty payments to the U.S. government, and some would be federal corporate income taxes. And some would go to shareholders of these oil companies who are, for the most part, U.S. citizens. That is an argument that, you know, it would create wealth, and the wealth would benefit U.S. citizens. But the idea that it would greatly or even noticeably lower gasoline prices and that that's a reason to drill is just not consistent with how the market works.
We're talking about President Bush's call for lifting the moratorium on offshore drilling off the coasts of the United States, of which we are enjoying one right here in California, and also perhaps trailing up to Anwar and digging there too. Your calls, your questions, your thoughts are very welcome on this subject. 866-893-5722 or 866-893-KPCC. We're speaking at the moment with Severin Borenstein. He's director of the University of California Energy Institute. Mr. Borenstein, perhaps you can help us to understand this. When Exxon or Chevron or Shell goes offshore and sinks a pipe and starts bringing up oil, do they then bring it right back to the United States and store it right here? Or, as you said before, does it enter the vast pool of the global oil market?
Well, whether it physically comes into the United States or not, it enters the vast pool of the world oil market. Oil is traded across the world. And if there's more oil coming out from offshore in California, that means California will import less oil from the rest of the world. The price at which that oil will be available to consumers will be the world oil price. Oil companies don't sell oil for cheaper to some customers than others. They sell it at the world price. And so whether that oil physically goes to one location or another is pretty much irrelevant. What really matters is the price that it's going to sell for in the market.
All right. Our number again, 866-893-5722. Your thoughts on this issue are very welcome. We're also joined by Ron Bailey. He's science correspondent for Reason Magazine and Reason.com website. Mr. Bailey, as we're hearing, this might not necessarily make an immediate impact on the prices that Americans are paying at the pump. And if it could take as much as 5 to 10 years, as Mr. Borenstein just said, does that mean we want to get going now, or is this just something, a reason to pursue other alternative energies?
Well, it's not either or. We can do both, as a matter of fact. We should start drilling now in order to have those supplies 5 years from now, 10 years from now, available. Also, the price of oil is extremely volatile, as we know. Back in the 1990s, it was about down to $10 a barrel, and that was because there was a huge amount of excess capacity in production. And at least some of the econometric models looking at this would say that if you could increase the excess capacity, that is the amount of oil produced per day, by 3 to 5 million barrels per day, the price would fall fairly steeply. And so we want to increase that capacity to produce oil, and that would put a significant downward pressure in the future on the price of oil.
Well, my understanding, though, is it's not so much about being able to get that oil up out of the ground. There's also the very limited refining capacity in the United States. What would we do about that?
It is true that we haven't built any new refineries in the United States since the 1970s, and instead have been expanding the capacity of our old refineries by about 1% or 2% per year. And we do need to expand that capacity in order to help. But that really isn't the real problem currently. The price of gasoline is being determined mostly not by refining capacity, but in fact by the price of oil.
Well, even so, with oil going at this level, more increased supply, again, and let's say we did open up the coast and we were drilling and we're bringing up all that oil. If we don't have the refining capacity, it seems like that's where the bottleneck is, and that's why the pump prices stay so high.
That is a possible bottleneck, but again, gasoline is the kind of thing that is sold internationally. And when we've had these bottlenecks, we've actually imported gasoline refined products from Europe, for example. So I understand your point, and it's important, and we should certainly expand our refining capacity. But it isn't absolutely as critical right now as to get actually more oil onto the market.
Now, the reason we've had a moratorium for about a quarter century is because of the potential environmental impact of spills and whatnot. Is that mitigated by runaway oil costs?
I don't think it's mitigated by that. The fact is that if you think about it, for example, when Katrina hit the Gulf Coast, several hundred oil wells went down and they were smashed by these terrible hurricanes, and there was almost no oil spillage whatsoever. In fact, our technologies are much better for controlling that kind of thing. So the potential environmental effects, while still there, are much lower than they used to be.
All right. Well, for more on that, let's turn to Daniel Heinerfeld. He's a spokesman for the National Natural Resources Defense Council. Mr. Heinerfeld, do you buy that? Are the environmental risks lower now than they were?
Hi, David. It's good to be here. No, I don't buy it. We have tremendous environmental impacts, potential impacts from offshore oil drilling. But let's step back for a second, because in fact, right now, there are nearly 8,000 active leases in the Outer Continental Shelf, and only about 1,600 to 1,700 of them are in production. That's a very important fact, because what that shows you is that this action here by the administration and by supporters in Congress is a gimmick. Americans are in real pain right now. We need real solutions. And what is going on is the president pushing a proposal that will be good for oil companies, that will be bad for Democratic politicians and other politicians who oppose these policies. And that's really what's going on. Opening up the Outer Continental Shelf, as the president has proposed, will do nothing to lower gas prices, as Mr. Bornstein said, now and barely at all in the future. And it is true that the technology for drilling is better today than it was decades ago. But many Californians don't remember the horrors of oil spills in the 60s, the late 60s, up in Santa Barbara and elsewhere. And that remains a risk today.
Do you find...
I don't remember because they haven't happened in the last 20, 30 years or so.
That's Ron Bailey from Reason Magazine. Mr. Bailey, as we've been hearing, though, it seems as though if we start pushing ahead aggressively to try and get the oil up now, ultimately we're talking only a few cents at the pump, aren't we?
Again, what you're trying to do is expand that amount of excess capacity to what it was back in. Probably we'll never get back to what it was in the 1990s, where there was excess capacity of several, almost 12 million barrels per day production. But if you can get it back to 3 or 4 million barrels, most oil economists will tell you that that would have a significant impact on the price. We're not going to see $10 a barrel oil ever again, but we could see $50 a barrel oil.
You think so?
Yes.
Daniel Heinerfeld at the NRDC, do you think that's a possibility?
Well, I think that the real issue is that we're avoiding the main challenge, which is to get off of oil. I mean, what we're talking about right now is doubling down on a failed energy policy. The oil companies want to keep us addicted to what they sell, to their oil. And what this administration, unfortunately, has failed to do over the past 8 years is to make any meaningful investment in alternatives. We have plenty of energy available to us from the sun, from wind, from biomass.
All right, we're going to catch up with that in just a sec. We're also going to take your calls at 866-893-5722. Should we be drilling offshore? You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm David Lazarus, sitting in for Larry Mantle.
Programming is supported by The Daily News, presenting the commentary of Dennis McCarthy and his stories about everyday people and their lives. You can read his columns in print, listen on podcasts, or visit his blog at dailynews.com.
This is 89.3 KPCC, Southern California Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Hetty Lynn Hurdies. The Southland's largest water district is asking customers to tighten their belts during the next 2 weeks while it repairs a major artery in its system. The Metropolitan Water District's Wally Yu says this spring crews found 4 weak spots along the 45-mile-long Sepulveda feeder pipeline. So Liu says they're closing down the pipe while they reline and secure those spots.
We want to make sure that we make the repairs before the summer high demands for water. And so that's why we, once we found out about it, we acted very quickly to coordinate the repairs with the various cities and local water agencies.
Metropolitan is asking customers to shorten their showers and hold off washing their cars. Some sections of Sepulveda near the National Cemetery in Westwood will shut down until the beginning of July. Well, you'll be able to find tomatoes at your favorite fast food eatery. Customers at Taco Bell and Wendy's are at least 2 chains making the move now that federal health officials have identified tomato crops that are safe from salmonella. It's 10:21 at 89.3 KPCC. Programming is supported by Rotary International. Rotary is a global network of volunteers dedicated to helping others in communities around the world. Whether it's free health screening in the Philippines, digging water wells in Ghana, or fighting illiteracy in the United States, the world is changing for the better because of the 1.2 million Rotary Club members who make it their business to care. To learn more, you can visit Rotary.org.
This is Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm David Lazarus sitting in for Larry Mantle. We're talking about President Bush's call to end the moratorium on offshore oil drilling. We've been looking at various sides of that issue. Your calls, your thoughts are very welcome. 866-893-5722 or 866-893-KPCC. Richard calling from L.A. Welcome to the program.
Yeah. This fiasco has been going on for four decades now, since the mid-70s, and not a realistic approach has been taken to solve the problem. If we could put a man on the moon in 5 years, how come this thing is dragged on for 45 years without any progress? Moreover, we're spending $700 billion a year on oil purchases overseas, which is destroying our economy. And my position is anything we can do now to alleviate that situation, no matter how small the steps are, should be taken, because we need the psychological lift here as well as the material benefits of reducing our oil expenditures overseas.
All right, Richard, I appreciate your thoughts on that. Let's take another call. Victor calling from downtown. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Yeah, I believe that this is a gimmick by the current administration, just like the other said. Look, we don't have twice as many people driving or using oil as we did 2 years ago, yet the price of oil has doubled. What we do have is a worldwide economy and the credit crunch, and investors are looking to put their money in things like commodities like oil. It's the traders that are driving up the oil prices. It's not an issue of supply in the market.
All right. Thank you very much for that. Severin Borenstein, director of the University of California Energy Institute. We've seen that the Saudis have been reluctant to step up their end. They're the largest oil producer, and yet they've just come out and said that they can increase their production. How big a difference does that make?
Well, the Saudi increase is going to lower prices a bit if it actually comes online, but we're facing increased demand at the same time, not in the United States, but in the rest of the world. Unfortunately, a lot of the politicians have this focus on speculation and traders and are trying to blame the financial markets for this. And that's just really misguided. There's no support for that being the cause of high oil prices. The fact is that even at $130 a barrel, 86 million barrels a day is getting produced, and there are buyers for it in the world. They are paying those prices. And so it's not speculators who are just trading paper. It's real buyers who are buying real oil and are willing to pay $130 a barrel for it.
So this is merely a matter of supply and demand.
It's a matter of demand continuing to increase, and supply, which had been keeping up until the last few years, seems to be stalling out. And when that happens, you're going to see price go up.
All right. Daniel Heinerfeld of the Natural Resources Defense Council, that would seem to make the case that anything we can do to boost supply would be a step in the right direction.
Well, I just think it's a red herring. I mean, as Mr. Borenstein explained at the top of the show, the amount of oil that is available within the United States is minuscule when you compare it to the global demand. It just won't do anything meaningful to lower prices. And once again, this is all just a distraction from the fact that we are 180 degrees off right now a responsible and sensible energy policy. We need to be encouraging efficiency. We need to be investing in renewable fuels. And as that caller said, we put a man on the moon in 5 years. We can certainly get off oil if we dedicate the political will and our resources to investing in those alternatives.
Again, our number is 866-893-5722. If you have some thoughts on this, Al calling from West L.A., welcome to the program.
Yeah, I was wondering why George Bush just doesn't do like he's always done and just use an executive order and whack these naysayers upside the head, because that's what needs to be done, at least in part. Besides, on top of that, all that information about oil shortages, I'm sorry, the data is just false. Lindsey Williams, the energy non-crisis. I'm sorry, you guys are just on the shortage part. But that aside, you know, there's a ton of stuff on the Internet
using stuff like HHO or Browning gas. You could, people even tell you how to put these devices in your car yourself. You could build it yourself, $100. That's all you got to do is just buy the info and buy the parts. And there's plenty of people out there rolling around, doubling their fuel mileage with these technologies that have just been, I'm sorry, just flat out ignored. Not to mention you can go on YouTube and see all the information on Stanley Miller. I believe he invented a vehicle that can run just totally off the water.
All right, Al, I appreciate your thoughts on that. Thank you very much. Ron Bailey, science correspondent for Reason Magazine. Among the various things President Bush called for was a renewed focus on oil shale, which in the past had been prohibitive in terms of cost. Is that now within reach with oil prices at these levels?
It is certainly within reach. There are, I would like to suggest, more environmental consequences of trying to go in that direction, and drilling offshore would be a lot safer and better for the environment. But one of the points that Mr. Heinefeld makes is correct in a certain sense, is that whatever the energy sources we're going to be using for the future, oil is not going to be playing a major role in 50 years or so. But we have to get through to the 50 years, so we need to drill now and start shifting away from oil to other sources of energy in the future. And I think that we're going to be doing that, and the markets are going to be shifting in that direction in any case. And one other point that I want to make, and I think is very important to make, is that part of the reason that demand is not keeping up, the supply is not keeping up with demand, is that most people don't realize that 80% of the oil resources of the world, the reserves of the world, are owned by national governments, places like Angola, Iran, Iraq, Russia, Venezuela, and so forth, and they produce oil with all the efficiency that the Soviets used to produce grain and the Soviets used to produce shoes. And we may be approaching peak oil in some sense, but it's political peak oil. It's because governments have failed to invest in their own production.
Now, for everybody playing at home, peak oil means that essentially demand is outstripping available supply, and supply will never catch up.
And it could do that, but again, the problem is that we have these governments. Pemex, Mexico is a government-owned oil company, is finally making a profit, but it was the only oil company in the world that wasn't making a profit, and only a government can ensure an oil company not making a profit.
All right. Let's take another call. Paul calling from Santa Monica. Welcome to the program. Paul, you there?
Hello, yes. Can you hear me?
You're on the air.
Yes, I've been driving an electric car for over 5 years now, made by Toyota, and the car has not used one drop of oil. As a matter of fact, I haven't been to a gas station in 5.5 years, and I run the car on sunlight because I use sunlight to generate electricity for my house and my car. And my electric bill last year was $44 for the entire year. So I would submit that the electric car is a big part of the solution. We have over 20 car companies now in development on electric cars. And so if you switch over to sunlight or to wind-generated electricity instead of oil, you're killing two birds with one stone.
But we don't have all that alternative energy doing oil or doing electricity. In fact, much of it is fueled in California by natural gas, which, again, we could boost with offshore oil drilling.
David, one quick point. This is Daniel Heinerfeld at NRDC. I think that first of all, what Paul is doing is fantastic, and more of us need to be doing the same. And there is a solution there that really could work for the whole country. But with regard to peak oil, the simple fact is that we are going to run out of atmosphere a long time before we run out of stuff to burn. And that really is the salient point here. We need to be aggressively investing in clean energy that is going to get us away not just from crude oil, but from oil shale and tar sands and these other ways of essentially chewing up the petrochemicals and burning them.
Severin Bornstein at the University of California Energy Institute, is it reasonable to think that we can put a greater emphasis on alternative energies at this point, or is there just simply no avoiding our reliance on fossil fuels?
Well, I think both things are true. We have to put a greater emphasis on alternatives, starting with things like hybrid electric cars and just getting better fuel economy with our cars, things that we can change very quickly. Unfortunately, the earlier caller who said there are things on the Internet that will double your fuel economy, there are certainly things that will claim they double your fuel economy, but the Federal Trade Commission has investigated them, and basically they don't work. The reality is that in the short run, we're still going to be very dependent on oil, and we need to recognize that. And, you know, drilling offshore may make sense if it can be done in an environmentally safe enough way, and I'm not an expert on that. But it's not going to fundamentally lower gas prices. Having a much more fuel-efficient car won't lower gas prices either, but it will lower your gas bill. Because if you're driving a 12-mile-a-gallon SUV and you switch to a 24-mile-per-gallon good-sized sedan, that's the same as cutting gas prices in half.
You know, often lost in the conversation about high oil prices is high natural gas prices, which, as I said a moment ago, contribute enormously to generating electricity in places, not least of which California. And the offshore, we use about, 21 trillion cubic feet of natural gas every year. And apparently more of that could be gained as well by going offshore. Do we overlook the fact that natural gas is a big factor in this as well?
Yeah, the fact is that a lot of natural gas is sitting underneath the continental shelf, available in areas where there are active leases, and it's not being developed. So again, it's kind of a red herring in this conversation. There are plenty of areas open right now to offshore drilling, and there is no need to increase them. What if oil companies want to pull more oil and gas out of those areas? All they need to do is start developing the leases they already hold.
All right, our number again, 866-893-5722. Your thoughts, your calls are very welcome. Kelly calling from CME. Welcome to the program.
Hello. You know, we're in the year of elections, and I'm going to keep this as concise as I possibly can, because it does seem like what's important is going to get lost in who's Republican and who's Democrat and who's supporting it. And the effect for us as the public is really going to be secondary to any of that. And so what I would like to say, you know, as a political process with your gentleman that you have on as guest today, do they see anything, as in the gentleman was saying, that we have leases that are available that are not being drilled? Is there something that can be brought forward, and the same as there's so much that goes on with back and forth with other bills that are put out there, so there's a true debate, so that there is something that is a requirement that they drill and use those leases that are already available to maximum capacity, and that they show that there is a benefit to the public for having done so before they drill, and also safety measures that can be required that are paid double, triple, who knows. There are requirements that are built into a bill that allows for drilling that can give the public some comfort, some protection, because this is a time of hysteria.
All right. I appreciate your thoughts on that. Thank you. Our number again, 866-893-5722. Nikki calling from Pasadena. Welcome to the program.
Hi. I was raised in oil, literally. I was raised in oil camps all over the world. And, you know, this is a bare-knuckle capitalist approach. I mean, you sell something for the maximum you can get from it. Also, I think that a lot of the point of this is to make sure that oil companies get the most money they can down to the last drop of oil. And what you'll see follow this is prying open drilling all in the nation, but that's not even the number one priority, because they're right, there's not that much oil. But it's going to subsidize the oil companies to do so heavily, and you're going to see more and more and more taxpayer money flooding into the oil companies, which is what Iraq was all about. Taxpayer money paying for the oil companies to have access to oil and to make profits.
All right, Nikki, appreciate your thoughts on that. Ron Bailey, science correspondent for Reason Magazine. A lot of consumers do look at it like that with a couple of oil guys in the White House and oil prices, was it tripling, quadrupling during their watch, that this is just a gimme to the oil companies. How is that not the case?
I'm not quite sure I understand what a gimme would be. As again, I was trying to point out earlier, most of the oil resources of the world are owned by national governments. It is not a gimme to the oil companies. In fact, if you look at the oil majors in the United States, the biggest oil companies control exactly about 3% of the world's oil supply.
I think we're talking about offshore drilling now, which is probably not going to be done by Iran, and it'll probably be done by Exxon.
It will be done by Exxon. And one of the things that Mr. Heinefeld keeps bringing up is that there are leases that aren't being used. But you can't have it both ways. Why would the oil companies be in favor of more leases being available if those leases that are not being used were so valuable already? It doesn't make any sense in a market interpretation of that. But the oil companies will make more money, obviously, if the price goes up, because the difference is between the price, the cost they have to pay for drilling the oil versus the world price. And what do you want them to do? To give the money back, or would you like them to invest that money in providing more energy resources to the world.
Daniel Heinerfeld at the Natural Resources Defense Council?
Yeah, I'm not sure what Mr. Bailey is saying. Are you suggesting that there are not inactive leases that could be operated right now?
No, I'm sure that there are some that are available, but why, on the other hand, would the companies be in favor of more leases if they already have an oversupply of leases that they could use, which is what you're implying?
Well, I'm saying that. I'm not implying it. It's the case. And there are all sorts of economic reasons why they might do that. And I think the deeper question is, why would their political allies in Congress do this in an election year? I think that perhaps is a more salient question.
All right. Very good point. 866-893-5722 is the number. Let's go to David in Pasadena. Welcome to the program.
Hi. One of the things that, one of the things that's driven, oil prices have gone up for several good market reasons, one of which is like the increased economic activity around the world, and that the U.S. is now one of many large buyers of oil. But the acceleration in oil prices in the last year, I think, can be directly tied to the devaluation of the dollar, because oil is traded in dollars, and the devaluation of our currency has resulted in oil prices going up. And I think the best solution on a short term to reduce oil prices is for the Federal Reserve to raise interest rates. I think our economy is in a perilous position, and with our currency really declining in value, and we need to improve the value of our currency, and the easiest way to do that is to raise interest rates.
All right. Appreciate your thoughts on that. Thank you. Lucy calling from downtown. Welcome to the program.
Yes. Hi, thank you for taking my call. I remember many years ago, over 30 years ago, going swimming off on the ocean off Rincon Beach, which is near Santa Barbara, and I came out with a patch of black tar stuck to me.
Ew.
Residue from the oil problems that had happened 10 years earlier with the oil drills. But in any event, having said that, I am in favor of taking advantage of our natural resources. And I do believe that when we have a treasure, it is our treasure, and we should dig for it. And I do believe that it can be done today in a more environmentally friendly way. And I'd like to remind your viewers.
Or listeners.
I'd also like to remind your viewers that there is almost nothing made today that isn't somehow a product of petroleum, including your contact lenses and that prosthetic leg that got blown off in Iraq. You know, but your leg that got blown off in Iraq, that prosthetic leg is made with petroleum products. So whether we like it or not, the use of petroleum is here to stay.
All right, Lucy, appreciate that. And mind you, we're not talking about my leg necessarily, which is intact. Thank you very much. I also want to thank Severin Borenstein, director of the University of California Energy Institute, Ron Bailey from Reason Magazine, and Daniel Heinerfeld from the Natural Resources Defense Council. And don't you go anywhere, because coming right up after the break, we're going to be talking about how high gas prices are impacting public transportation and whether this is enough to finally get you onto the bus or the subway. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC, Southern California Public Radio. I'm David Lazarus, sitting in for Larry Mantle.
Programming is supported by UCR. The University of California, Riverside is inventing your future with innovations in nanotechnology, robotics, and biotechnology. You can discover more online at ucr.edu.
Programming is supported by the restaurant at Hotel Bel Air, a member of Relay and Chateau Gourmand, recipient of a 2007 Zagat Dining Award, Mediterranean-inspired cuisine in a country estate setting. Reservations at hotelbelair.com. Pro and anti-gay marriage activists sought to show their best face yesterday as gays and lesbians legally wed for the first time in California history. KPCC's Frank Stoltz reports.
In a fundraising email to supporters, ProtectMarriage.com President Ron Prentice warned against fierce protests or hostile demonstrations against same-sex marriage. He said the media would use them to portray anti-gay marriage activists as unreasonable. Prentice urged supporters not to fall into this trap and to keep focused on the November ballot initiative that would again ban same-sex marriages. Leaders of the same-sex marriage movement likewise implored their side to keep focused on November, even as wedding bells rang. They discouraged flamboyant or group ceremonies that might suggest gay men and lesbians don't take marriage seriously and could scare off potential supporters of their cause. Analysts say image will matter in what's expected to be a close vote. Polls indicate California voters are nearly evenly split on same-sex marriage. Frank Stoltz, 89.3 KPCC.
And in case you were wondering, L.A. County issued 648 marriage licenses to same-sex couples on the first full day that these became available. The county also presided over 279 same-sex weddings just yesterday. SIG alert in downtown L.A. on the 101 North from 4th Street to 1st. Caltrans has the right lane blocked until 2 o'clock for road work. It's 1041.
This is Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm David Lazarus from the Los Angeles Times, sitting in for Larry Mantle. Well, we've just been discussing high oil prices and President Bush's call for offshore drilling once again. Now let's look back at the pump. We've got record gas prices. I've been seeing prices for regular unleaded $4.60, $4.70 in some places. Nasty, nasty business for anyone who's filling up their car. So the question that I'm going to put on the table now, how high do gas prices have to go before you are back onto public transportation, buses and subways? Here in Southern California, we look at our cars as our God-given birthright, and by God, we're not going to give them up easily. And yet, you can save, well, $9, $10 a day if you were to be taking public transportation instead of the car just once a week or so. So are you taking public transportation now as a result of these record high gas prices? And if not, what would it take to get you onto mass transit? Your thoughts are welcome. 866-893-5722 or 866-893-KPCC. And to ease us into this conversation, we are joined by Dave Sotero. He's a spokesman for the Metropolitan Transportation Administration. Mr. Sotero, welcome to the program.
Thanks, David.
Okay, so you guys just came out with some new numbers on ridership. What are we looking at?
Yeah, we recently released our ridership numbers. Our rail lines are growing. We've had a 6% increase year over year on the rail lines in Los Angeles County. It's basically we've gone from 7.1 million boardings to 7.6 million boardings for the month of May. It's one of the highest one-month increases on record.
And yet buses, a different story.
Yes, buses are a little bit different. We actually had in May of last year a surge in gas prices just before the driving season. We had high numbers in the month of May. What we witnessed after that was a fare increase, which kind of raised the price of our day pass, which caused some bus riders to make fewer discretionary trips. Perhaps they bought the one-way cash fares instead. And that's the reason our current bus ridership is off from last year. But we do expect that in June we will see an upswing in bus ridership as well.
Readers of my column in the newspaper know that as an experiment, I spent all of last week riding public transportation here in L.A. to and from my home on the west side to the office of the L.A. Times downtown. I rode local buses, rapid buses, express buses, the subways. And what I found was the subway is great. Anything that gets you off the road is terrific, but anything that keeps you on the road, well, you're still facing a lot of the same problems, which is all that congestion. Are you finding, Dave Sotero from the MTA, that running a bus line is a losing proposition if you want to offer a viable alternative to people to their cars?
Well, bus services is definitely a viable alternative, especially in Los Angeles County. We have very substantial bus services, and bus services are fast. If you look at the Orange Line, for example, that is a bus system that operates like a train system in that it has fewer stops, it has its own dedicated right-of-way and more frequent service. And ridership on that bus line specifically has increased about 1.3% year over year. So there is a specific example of a bus line that is experiencing growth at this time.
All right. And once again, we are also opening up the switchboards to your thoughts on whether high gas prices have led you to take public transportation where you might not have in the past. And if not, what would it take to get you onto buses and subways? Our numbers are 866-893-5722 or 866-893-KPCC. Let's take a call. David calling from Tustin. Welcome to the program.
Hi. I just wanted to point out that it's not that we don't want to take buses or public transportation. It's that they're so terrible. I lived in New York City and in San Francisco. Both of the places, it's very convenient to take places, you know, work and other businesses. But to, for example, in Orange County, it'll take you 3 hours to go something that would take 5 minutes or, 10 minutes from, like, let's say, Anaheim to Irvine.
All right. Appreciate your thoughts on that. Again, 866-893-5722 for your thoughts on riding public transportation in Southern California. Judy calling from Santa Monica. Welcome to the program.
Hi, David. Your previous caller hit it on the head that not everybody is capable of changing their behavior because they're middle-class, working-class people who have jobs that in many cases it's simply not possible for them to use a bike or public transportation, that we have to get prices down along with encouraging people to use renewables, to take public transit, and that the best way to do this is market regulation, which is something that the president didn't talk about, but John McCain did yesterday, and pretty forcefully.
All right, Judy, appreciate your thoughts on that. Dave Sotero from the MTA, here in the L.A. area, a lot of people stigmatize bus travel. It's looked at as, public transportation for them and not us, which is a coded way of looking at all the socioeconomic forces at work here. What would it take to make the buses as egalitarian as the subways?
Well, I think bus service does have a certain amount of stigmatization that you described there. But it's important to realize that the bus service plays a key role. A lot of the bus services do connect with rail transit. Metrolink, for example, their ridership has just gone through the roof recently. They're expecting this week to hit 50,000 boardings. But buses play a key role. And a lot of people don't realize that it's not just local buses we're talking about. Metro also offers freeway express buses and rapid buses. In fact, at the end of this month, we're going to be introducing 6 new Metro Rapid buses throughout L.A. County. Now, that's a substantial investment in fast, efficient bus service that the public need only learn more about all of the types of bus services we offer to find a solution that's going to fit their needs.
All right. Again, our question for you, are you taking public transportation because of these record high gas prices? And if not, what would it take to get you back into mass transit? Our number is 866-893-5722. Karen calling from Hollywood. Welcome to the program.
Hi. I wanted to echo kind of what the other callers were saying is, if the buses, if you want people on the buses, they've got to run on time. I was trying to run some errands and it was 20 minutes late. The second time I did it, it was 30 minutes late. I can't rely on that.
Well, if they could somehow have a dedicated bus lane or something that would actually move it quicker, would that be enough to do it for you?
That would be wonderful. I'd love to take the bus to work, but right now, as someone else was saying, it'll take me at least an hour to go to Hollywood from Glendale, and it's 20 minutes right now with my car. My time's more valuable than that.
All right. Appreciate your thoughts on that, Karen. I know in my own experience, when I was taking the buses and subways all last week, I took a local bus from the west side. It took me about an hour and a half to get downtown. And coming back during rush hour, it took 2 hours. That was 3.5 hours altogether on the bus for what was a 32-mile round trip that normally takes me about 45 minutes by car each way. So Dave Sotero from the MTA, as long as the buses are just crawling in that sense, how can they be the viable alternative that I repeatedly hear Angelenos are calling for?
Well, you have to look at various technologies for bus. There are ways in which buses can move faster through very heavily congested corridors. If you look at the Orange Line, that is a dedicated bus rapid transit system that operates on its own right-of-way. In other words, it doesn't compete with automobile traffic as it gets from North Hollywood to Canoga Park. And projects like that, in terms of bus service, are able to save valuable time off a bus commute.
All right. Our number again, 866-893-5722 for your thoughts on this subject. Sybil calling from Cerritos. Welcome to the program.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment. I used to take a bus when my job was in Signal Hill, and it was one bus, and it would take me about an hour to get there. And it was okay. I was fine with that because I live in Artesia. They moved closer to my house to Cerritos, which is just the next city. And when I search for buses, it would take me 3 buses and an hour to get here. And I was like, that's ridiculous. So that's why I decided to go in the car, which takes me less than 10 minutes to go to work. And now I'm from South America. In my country, you step out of your house, you go to the corner, you have so many choices of public transportation. I just don't understand how such a big city as Los Angeles doesn't have something like that.
All right. Thank you very much for your thoughts on that. I appreciate that. Sheila calling from Culver City. Welcome to the program.
Hi there. Well, I guess I'm just going to offer like a little bit of another perspective, which is that I have been very satisfied with the public transportation around me. Culver City operates buses. Santa Monica operates buses. Los Angeles operates buses. So I feel like whenever I need to get somewhere, I can do it pretty quickly, and I find that the bus sits in the same traffic as my car would, except it costs me a lot less. It's just $1.25. And I get to read instead of kind of be annoyed at other drivers.
The stress factor seems like it's a big deal. I know after my column on Sunday, a lot of people wrote to me to say, I just can't handle the traffic anymore. I'd rather sit and read.
Well, definitely. And the other thing I do is I team it up with my bike. Sometimes if there's going to be too many bus connections, I'll just take my bike instead. And as a goal, I've been trying to exercise more. So when you do a 4-mile bike ride, it takes about the same time, maybe a half an hour, as it would sitting in traffic in the car. And you get there and you're rejuvenated and you've had your exercise already. So I think that teaming up bike and bus is a great way to do it.
Well, Sheila, I'm glad somebody finally brought up the bikes. Now, I tried riding my bike here in L.A. and I got scared to you know what. It was terrifying.
What was terrifying?
Oh, okay. Dave Sotera at the MTA. I'll tell you what was terrifying. You have doors opening up. You've got cars flying past you. And there's an attitude down here in Southern California that I didn't really see as much in Northern California, where I moved from last year, because the prevailing attitude is cars are sacrosanct. They have the right of way in all cases. And a biker is basically getting whatever comes to him or her by venturing out into cars' territory.
Well, I'd like to say that you definitely need to put safety first when you're riding a bicycle in L.A. traffic. That goes without saying. But as long as you're wearing your helmet and you're staying on the right side of the road, it is safer to you can ride safely in L.A. County. I personally ride a bike. I'm kind of a mixed mode commuter. I use a bike from my house to the bus stop, and then I use the bus to the train stop, and then I use the train to come into downtown LA. That sort of mixed mode is really the secret to getting around in LA, because as other people have indicated, a bus line may not stop in front of their house. It may stop about half a mile away, and how are they going to get there? Because as you know, nobody walks in Los Angeles. The easiest way to do that would be to bike to a transit stop. There's one within a half-mile radius of most residences in L.A. County, and then complete your commute that way. And as the caller before me mentioned, you're commuting and you're exercising at the same time, which is a wonderful benefit.
Our number again, 866-893-5722. Victoria calling from West L.A. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. I just want to say I moved here from New York only 6 months ago, and I can't believe I'm actually in shock that the city does not take on a big master plan to think about public transportation, especially considering how many wonderful traffic consultants there are here in the city alone.
What would you do to fix it?
Well, I'm not a traffic consultant, but I think the city should sit down and come up with a large master plan to think about this, to address this problem in a big picture way. I mean, I don't think it's an issue of, well, the orange line is great or this line is great. I mean, there's a big problem here, and considering what's coming with fuel issues, a big solution needs to happen.
All right, Victoria, I appreciate your thoughts on that. Of course, a few billion dollars wouldn't hurt either. Chris calling from Glendale. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
I would love to take the bus. I drive 20,000 miles a year, and that isn't commute miles. I'm, you know, I'm an actor, so I have to go to appointments, et cetera. And not only are the schedules unreliable, but it seems that the different systems compete with each other rather than cooperate with each other. And I don't know why Metrolink and Metrorail aren't linked together. I don't know why Metrolink doesn't run on the weekends. I'm heading for a wardrobe fitting now in Culver City. I tried to read that map that's on the MTA website. It was totally incomprehensible. So maybe if I walked around with a GPS, a laptop, and an iPhone, I could probably get from place to place. But I think that they really should go from models of other countries where public transportation is the norm and an automobile is considered a luxury, and look at the way they do it. And granted, it doesn't work in some countries as well, but other places, it works beautifully. And when the system works here, it works beautifully. If you happen to have a destination, I could get to my storage place in Canoga Park from my office in Los Feliz was great. I love the Orange Line. I love taking the Red Line. I love taking, you know, any of those dedicated systems.
All right, I appreciate your thoughts on that, Chris. Dave Sotero at the MTA. So, is the system not accessible enough?
Well, I just wanted to correct a couple of things that the previous caller said. He said that the Metro and Metrolink connections aren't there. They're actually very close connections with Metro bus services. We do operate buses directly to these Metrolink stations. And actually, there are weekend services on Metrolink. I would encourage the previous caller to go to Metrolink's website to find out what those are. A map of the entire LA County region with all of our bus lines may be a bit hard to read, but it doesn't prevent somebody from doing a little research in advance, going to the Metro.net website and using the trip planner. And within a couple of minutes, you can go from point A to point B on public transit fairly easily. You just have to figure that part out in advance.
Let's take another quick call. Peter calling from Los Feliz. Welcome to the program.
Oh, yes. Hi. Thanks for taking my call. There's too much only served by buses, particularly in the, I don't know, I guess it's called the L.A. Basin, basically that swath of territory from Silver Lake all the way to Santa Monica. And we need, I guess we have that along the 105, an east-west line, but we need an east-west line that goes, you know, straight through the area that I'm talking about, as well as a couple of north-south lines, maybe one around Vine and another one around the Sepulveda Boulevard. And then you'll see ridership jump way up, and people take that and connect it with buses, but it's just not convenient. I mean, as a former New Yorker, it's just not convenient, and once it becomes convenient, people will use it.
All right, Peter, appreciate your thoughts. Dave Sotero at the MTA giving you the last word. Subway to the Sea, when are we going to have one?
Well, that's a good question. We're currently about 1 year into studying the alternatives for that project, and we've limited the alternatives down to a couple. It's looking like what we will recommend will be a subway solution. There's a number of hurdles that would have to be overcome for a West Side Subway project to happen.
All right, Dave Sotero, thank you very much for joining us. Don't you go anywhere. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC, Southern California Public Radio. I'm David Lazarus, sitting in for Larry Mantle.